Okay. Hey, boys and girls, sorry. Yeah, just stepped out of the junior high classroom, sorry. Men and women, ladies and gentlemen, and if there are boys and girls here, welcome. First of all, we got some new CDs back there, at least new for you if you want to take them. We got a 3-CD set. They're Christmas CDs. Coming of Messiah, 3 CDs. Kind of go through the Old Testament prophecies, the genealogy, a variety of things on these 3 CDs. And then I've got a collection here of just Christmas messages, just in time for the holiday seasons. Take those. There's 6 just random messages here from Christmas's past, Christmas's present, and Christmas futures, if you want to do that. And I would like to ask you to take this one. This one's different. We made this several years ago. It's a little CD pack. It's actually a Christmas card, but it's got parts of some of these messages scattered together with a little bit of music. And my lovely wife reading scripture. So you can put that in your car. It's a little bit different. It's got some music to it. It's a little different. But anyway, take those if you want those. And Merry Christmas. Also, Bible study tomorrow night, Tuesday night at our house. We're not going to be doing that tomorrow night because of, there's originally a Christmas concert we're supposed to go to that we're going to try to get to. But as you know, that's probably not going to happen with the weather. But either way, no Bible study tomorrow night. So, and if you haven't been coming to the Tuesday night Bible study, it's at our house. You're sure welcome. It's 745th Street, West Des Moines. It's a home. It's a living room. So we got some lawn chairs. You come on in. I got a board just like this on the wall. We're doing Ephesians right now. You're just in time to get the end of the book of Ephesians here. So, and I think we'll maybe do the book of Acts next. That's what I'm thinking. But we'll see. I'd like to ask if there's any questions, but I'm not. And I'm just going to pray, and we'll get started. Father, we come to you tonight in the name of Jesus, and we thank you again for the opportunity to be here in this place, but also in this country and part of the Church of Jesus Christ. We ask that we may hear your word, that we may be able to apply it to our lives, that we may find direction in our thinking and direction in our living, that we may indeed fulfill your plan for our lives. We ask that we may see revival in our lives here in our country, in our churches, that again we may do the will that you've called us to. Again, we thank you for the chance to be here, and we look forward to Jesus Christ's return. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, a couple things I'd like to ask you to do is open your books, first of all, your framework books, and let's go to kind of where we're at and the timeline and just kind of see. It's page 146. Not much left of our timeline to finish the Old Testament. In theory, we should finish the Old Testament tonight. All we've got is the book of Ezra, Nehemiah, and Malachi, which, of course, could take us 4 years to probably get to that. But I just want to rush through that if we can. The year that we're looking at, we begin in 458 in Ezra. We're going to begin in chapter 7 of Ezra, 458. That's how far we got last time. And you can look on the page 146 of your framework books. In 457, Ezra completes a 3 or 4 month long journey back to Jerusalem. Both Ezra and Nehemiah are going to be coming back from Babylon or Susa or the Persian Empire now to Jerusalem. First Ezra, and then Nehemiah is going to come. They're going to have 2 different things in mind. They're going to interact in our story tonight. In 446, in November, December of 446, Nehemiah is in Susa and he hears a report about the condition of Jerusalem. Now, here's a map of Jerusalem. I'm going to have you turn there in your books next, in the back of your book. But I've got some gates on there that I've added on. These are the gates that Nehemiah is going to inspect. It's not going to look, not going to look like this. It's all broken down. The walls in Nehemiah, when he arrives, have been broken down and burnt. Your immediate reaction is think, yeah, it's left over from the days of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar burnt the city. And that's obviously possible, and there's damage left from that time. But remember, they've been living here since 537, 536, when they came back and rebuilt the temple up here in Jerusalem. So they've made some kind of attempt to build those walls. It would appear at least a good idea that the reason the gates continue to be in a burnt condition and torn down, the walls are down, is anything they try to do, you're going to see the opposition coming from Samaria down north, coming from across the Jordan. They continue to keep the city in ruins. They will not, the governor of Samaria, the governor of Transjordan, continues to come across and keep the Jews in a hard place so they cannot rise up. And you'll see that very clearly in Nehemiah. So possibly the destruction Nehemiah is going to see is a result of the attacks right here during Ezra's time. But unless he's going to, in 446, Nehemiah is going to come over and in visit, or beginning his visit in Jerusalem. He's going to be there for a period of time, about 20 years. Then he's going to return back to Persia, to Susa, to continue his work. And in 445, you got a breakdown of a variety of things he's going to do. Chapters 2 through 9 of Nehemiah take place in 445. 433, Nehemiah is recalled to Artaxerxes to come back to Persia. So it's amazing how close a relationship he's got. Both Ezra and Nehemiah have very close relations with Artaxerxes. And then in 432, the book of Malachi is going to be written. Right about the same time Nehemiah leaves, Malachi is going to begin writing. And you're going to see a lot of things at the end of Nehemiah that are very interesting as far as what you wouldn't expect to be taking place. Now, if you would go to the back of the book, and you can, I'll just show you where this map is at. Page 536, you've got what is supposed to be the same map here. I've added a few gates on there. And as I was getting ready for class, then I noticed there to the east of the map, or on the left side of the map, I'm not sure, I've got the Valley Gate and the Dung Gate over there in the Hinnom Valley, and I'm not sure why I've got those there. They're supposed to be up on the wall like this, and so I'm not sure who to blame that on, but I'm sure it's not my mistake. it probably is. But anyway, that's where we're at right now, so keep that in mind. I'm going to lay this down now, and we're going to go to chapter 7 of Ezra, and finish the book of Ezra and head to the book of Nehemiah. A lot of interesting things are taking place here. Now, chapter 7 begins the year 458, and Ezra is going to arrive in Jerusalem. It's going to take him a while to get there. Here we go, chapter 7, verse 1. After these things, I will mention this. Ezra appears to be the author of this book. He's one of the scribes. He's one of the ones that gathered the information, wrote under the inspiration. So possibly these chapters 1 through 6 have been written by Ezra. He's just catching up on history, the things that took place, maybe putting documents together. And then his part of the story kind of picks up here in chapter 7, nonetheless. After these things, during the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, again, this would be Xerxes' son. This would be Esther's, probably like 58 years old during this time. This would be her stepson. Of course, there's probably no relation there at all. She didn't help raise him or anything. But nonetheless, that's kind of where we're at in time. Ezra, son of, now watch this. There's a long list going up to verse 6, from verse 2 to verse 6. Ezra, son of Shariah, son of Azariah, son of Hilkiah, all the way through, going all the way back to Aaron, the chief priest. So notice right there, when Ezra shows up, he has his paperwork intact. We saw earlier in the book of Ezra, and we can bump into it again in Nehemiah, where certain priests lost their privileges to be a priest, to operate, to receive their daily allotment of food or provisions because they've lost their genealogy. We began the genealogy of Jesus yesterday in church, and some people look at that genealogy at the beginning of Matthew. You know, it's like a long genealogy, and you think, well, I'm sure they just made that up. It's like, well, maybe in some cultures they would have to, but in the Jewish culture, the genealogy told you so many things. I mean, for a priest, it gave you an occupation. For a royal line of David, it lets you know that you were related to David and in line for the throne or where you would fall in that position. It kept you in your correct tribe. It kept your inheritance in order. We see it in the scriptures, to lose your genealogy was to lose your identity in Israel. I mean, you could still be a Jew, but there are certain things you couldn't participate in. So again, just a mention, when we get into the Christmas season, you're going to keep bumping into the genealogies and church or Bible study or something, realize those are not fabricated. For Matthew and Luke to go and have access to Jesus' genealogy, it's a real deal. They were kept in the temple. And if they weren't in the temple, they were kept somewhere else preserved by the family. And notice here again an example of Ezra's genealogy. And he is not afraid to put the genealogy in place. It's like, well, that's pretty boring. Well, maybe to me in you know, Des Moines, Iowa in 2009, I don't care about his genealogy. But to Ezra in the year 458, this gave him authority. This let him know who he was, and he is a priest. Well, nonetheless, we're in verse 6. This Ezra came from Babylon. He was a teacher well-versed in the law of Moses. So he is coming now to teach the people, which the Lord, the God of Israel, had given. The king had granted him. Notice the king. Now, whenever we bump into the name or the word king, remember, think more emperor. Think Artaxerxes. Give you an idea. Not just a king somewhere. Artaxerxes. The king had granted him everything he asked. So again, Ezra's not just a Jew stumbling across the desert, coming back to Jerusalem saying, hey, I'm here. He's got access to the king. He's got permission from the king. He's got provisions from the king. Plus, he's in the line of Aaron all the way back to the days of Moses. This man shows up, well-versed in the law. He is somebody who's showing up. Verse 7, some of the Israelites, including priests, Levites, singers, gatekeepers, and temple servants, also came up to Jerusalem in the seventh year of King Artaxerxes. Ezra arrived in Jerusalem. In the fifth month of the seventh year, he began his journey from Babylon, the first day of the first month. So basically, he leaves on April 8, 458, and he arrives August 4th of the same year. So you figure about a four-month journey, and we're going to see as we get into this, there's going to be some delay of kind of getting everything started. He's going to, if we hurry up and get here, he's going to begin, get ready, have everybody camped out ready to leave from a certain canal. This is their meeting place. And when he checks, there's no Levites there. Where's all the Levites? No one's coming back. So he had to send men into the people of Babylon, or the exiles of Babylon, and say, hey, we need some Levites to come back with us. We've got a job to do. And remember, a lot of these people going back, they're not necessarily families. This is not like a camping trip. This is not something you got your RV and, hey, we're going to go to Jerusalem. This is, you know, like going to the moon in a sense, not quite that extreme. But it's like you're going to a different place. And so families aren't necessarily loading up all the kids and going to Jerusalem. It may be a lot of men that are going. And that's going to create a problem later on in Ezra and in Nehemiah when they start looking at who the men are marrying. There's a variety of things taking place or reasons for, but a lot of them are marrying outside of the bounds of Israel, marrying into the Samaritan line and the Moabites and different things like this. And it's like, well, one reason is they didn't bring any women along, or they didn't have as many women as they might have needed. But keep that in mind. This is not just a family trip. This is, they're starting a new community or joining a new community. Okay, anyway, he takes about a four-month journey. It says the gracious hand of God was on him, so it only took 4 months. For Ezra had devoted himself to study and observance of the law of the Lord and to teaching its decrees. So study, observing, and teaching the laws. Verse 11. This is a copy of the letter Artaxerxes had given Ezra, the priest. And this is the letter that we talked about. This is the issuing of the decree. Potentially, there's like what I gave you several weeks ago, so four different ways of viewing that, the fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy, the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. There'll be 483 years until the Anointed One comes. This is one of those spots. This one I think is correct, but there's others that you can work with. But notice this letter, who's bringing this letter? Ezra is the one who receives the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. And Ezra, or Artaxerxes, had just previously, after there had been kind of some hubbub about what's going on in Jerusalem, he said, I just shut it down. We're not going to build it. We're shutting down the building until I say so. And it was a few months later, something comes up. Ezra apparently got to him. And Artaxerxes now says, okay, I'm ready. You can start rebuilding the city. And so now you've got this letter. We could read through this letter, but it goes from verse 13, or actually verse 12, up to verse 26 of kind of giving instructions on what's to take place. And again, I'd like to read that to you, but we want to keep moving. But anyway, chapter 8, now he arrives in chapter 8 is going to begin the journey back. He's got permission, he's got the letter, and chapter 8, verse 1. These are the family heads and those registered with them who came up with me from Babylon during the reign of King Artaxerxes. And now you've got a list of people who came with him. And again, notice some people got 70 people with him, 300 people with him, or 300 men with him. It doesn't just say people. Sometimes it just says 300 men came with him. Meaning, well, where's the women and children? Well, they're not coming yet. We may send for them later. But that gives you a list up to verse 15 then of who came back with Ezra. Now remember, there's already people there, but Ezra's bringing back a new wave. Verse 15. He now begins to talk about the beginning of his journey. I assembled them at the canal that flows toward Ahava. And so this would be like we saw the Kibar Canal. That's where Ezekiel was at. Here now is where they're at. It's a canal probably flowing into the Euphrates or flowing around, you know, Babylon. Or, you know, it's a canal that they've got there. And they meet. It's a meeting place. We camped there 3 days. They're getting organized. When I checked among the people and the priests, I found no Levites there. So I summoned these men and says, hey, go find some Levites for us to take back. We need some helpers in the temple. And they came back and they found a man, a capable man in verse 18. And it mentioned that he had 18 men with him. And also another man came with his, who's a descendant, and his brothers came, descendants of Levi. They came along with 20 men. They also brought an interesting thing right here in verse 20, 220 temple servants. Now, if you understand, that's what the word means, temple servants. It's the word nethinim, and it means a temple servant. But if you remember, the priests were the ones who did the officiating, help me out right there. And the Levites were given by Moses, by God through Moses, the Levites were given to assist the priest in doing all the work they had to do. But now, in Solomon's day, some servants came into play that were servants for the Levites. So you've got priests who are being served and helped by the Levites, but the Levites, they've got other assistants helping them get things done. And again, that's not amazing when you understand what's going on in the temple. And we've talked about that before, all the sacrifices, all the business, how many hundreds and thousands of people would be coming and going from Passovers and different feasts. They would need a lot of help. We remember in Hezekiah's day where the people, the priests were ashamed because they didn't get ready. They didn't realize how many people were showing up. So again, it's not surprising that they need this many people helping run the temple. Verse 21, there by the Ahava Canal, I proclaimed a fast so that we might humble ourselves before God and ask Him for the safe journey for us, our children, with all of our possessions. So again, there are some children coming back with them and all their possessions. Now notice, they're going to leave, and it's going to be a four-month journey. There's bandits in this country. It's a dangerous place to go. Persian Empire is a fairly stable, at least at this time in Artaxerxes' time, but again, it's a dangerous trip. But notice, because of Ezra's talk about doing God's will, of being called back to the city, notice this right here. He's fasting and praying so that they can have protection. But look in verse 22. He says, I was ashamed to ask the king, or Artaxerxes, for soldiers and horsemen to protect us from our enemies on the road, because we had told the king, the gracious hand of our God is on everyone who looks to Him, but His great anger is against all who forsake Him. So in other words, there must have been some testimony going on between Ezra and Artaxerxes, saying, our God, if you seek Him, He'll protect you, but He will be against you if you forsake Him. And we are seeking Him, and so His hand is with us. So kind of part of his testimony was, how can he go now to the king, as he's seeking his God, who's going to protect him, go to the king and say, oh, can we get some soldiers to help us out? It's kind of like, well, what about your God? And so our Ezra's kind of like, I was ashamed, because I've been testifying how great our God was, to go to the king and say, you know, we might need some backup, just in case. So he says, they said, are we going to get some soldiers? No, not after my testimony, we're not getting soldiers. We're going to fast and pray. And so they do. So verse 23, we fasted and petitioned our God about this, and He answered our prayer. Then I set apart 12 of the leading priests together with some of these guys that came along. And notice here, when He takes these 12 of the leading priests, and now the reason they need to be concerned about bandits and beginning robbed is how much stuff they're taking back. It's not just their, you know, their possessions and their families. They've got gold and provisions that have been provided by the king to take back and offer sacrifices, to buy sacrifices, and to invest in the community. So they're loaded with gold and silver. So what Ezra does is he takes 12 men and divides it up. In verse 25, I weighed out to them the offering of silver and gold and the articles that the king, his advisors, his officials, and all the Israelites had presented there, had donated to the house of God. I weighed out to them 650 talents of silver, silver articles weighing 100 talents, 100 talents of gold. They're loaded down with stuff. And each of these 12 men have got this supply that's not theirs. They're just in charge of it, from getting it from point A to point B. And point B is the temple in Jerusalem. And they begin this four-month journey with these men, having things weighed out to them. They didn't just say, well, you take this, you take that, why don't you grab that pile and let's go. They weighed it out to them, because when they get back, guess what they're going to do? They're going to weigh it back in again and find out if anything's missing. And we'll see that here in a minute. Verse 28, I said to them, you as well as these articles are consecrated to the Lord. The silver and gold are a freewill offering to the Lord, the God of your fathers. Guard them carefully until you weigh them out in the chambers of the house of the Lord in Jerusalem before the leading priests. So there's already priests and Levites there. They said, we're going to take these and we're going to weigh them out in front of them. And now in verse 31, on the 12th day of the first month, we set out from the Ahava Canal. So they'd been there for several days to go to Jerusalem. The hand of our God was on us, and He protected us from enemies and bandits along the way. So we arrived in Jerusalem, where we rested 3 days. So after about a four-month journey, the same thing's going to happen to Nehemiah when he arrives after his journey. He's also going to take 3 days. And again, it seems like that must have been either a common practice or about what you needed to recover from a 3 or 4 month journey from Babylon. It takes 3 days, and they get there, and they just rest for 3 days. On the fourth day, in the house of our God, guess what they do? The first thing they do, they take the gold and silver in. We weighed out the silver and gold and the sacred articles in the hands of the priest there. Tells you how they did that. In verse 34, everything was accounted for, which is amazing. One, there's no thieves on the road that took it. There's no, you know, conniving on the way there, people hiding stuff, or someone trying to take a little bar of gold or something. Everything was there. Verse 35, then the exiles who had returned from captivity sacrificed burnt offerings. Now, this is the first time. These are exiles that had, many of them had probably been born in Babylon. This is their first time to be in Jerusalem, and definitely their first time to offer sacrifices in the Jewish temple. They'd heard about it, but now they're there for the first time offering sacrifices. This was, you know, it'd be like you offering sacrifice in a sense. You'd never done it before. It was their first experience with it at that sense. Verse 36, they also delivered the king's orders to the royal satraps and to the governors of Trans-Euphrates and all that had gave assistance to the people of the house of God. So they take the orders and they got, you know, the letter that Artaxerxes wrote is given to the people up in Samaria, Trans-Jordan. Anyone who's there in a governing capacity for Artaxerxes received a copy of the letter saying, hey, we're back and this is what we're going to do. We've got permission to build the temple or continue to work on the city. Verse 9, chapter 9. After these things had been done, the leaders came to me and said, the people of Israel, including the priests and Levites, are not keeping themselves separate from the neighboring peoples with their detestable practices like those of the Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites, Jebusites. And we're right back to the days of Judges where there were some practices in the land that had become corrupt. Remember, the Assyrians had moved out the Israelites from the north and had brought in a variety of pagan people. They'd intermarried with the remaining Jews and they became known as Samaritans, part Jew, part Gentile. Well, now these Jews come back from exile from Babylon and they begin to intermarry with the people in the land. And the problem with that is, and you can see, we can study this somehow sometime, but God, you can see in Jesus' genealogy in Matthew chapter 1, God is not against, in a sense, foreign people. He's not against the foreign women like Rahab or Ruth or Bathsheba or Tamar, as mentioned in Jesus' genealogy. What he's against is their practices of their culture. Solomon derailed himself because he loved many foreign women. And the problem with these foreign women, it wasn't that they were foreign, it's that they brought with them foreign ways, foreign practices, foreign gods, foreign philosophies, false philosophies, and it began to affect them. And that's what's taking place right here. Notice in verse 1, I think. Is that what it is? Yeah, verse 1. It's a long verse, halfway through, almost towards the end. It mentions detestable practices. It wasn't just the foreign people or the foreign women. It was their detestable practices, their false religions. I mean, the same thing's true for us as far as believers is, it's not a matter of race or gender or something like this. What it's a matter of is your worldview. What do you think? The danger comes in the philosophy. Well, nonetheless, they make this very simple. Foreign women or foreign people have foreign practices or detestable practices. Well, they say even the priest, remember how Ezra gave his genealogy. And now he gets to Jerusalem and the very priest that he's a member of, the very priest that he's part of, they're marrying the foreign women, which means their children are now, how's this going to fit into the line of Aaron? You can just see how Ezra's, this is going to be kind of a point of contention. Well, watch, verse 3. When I heard this, I tore my tunic and cloak, pulled hair from my head and beard, and sat down appalled. Couldn't believe it. Was not expecting this. I'm not sure if you've ever done this before. You hear about this great group somewhere, and you can't wait to go see these people, and Ezra's going to go visit Jerusalem and visit the priests in Jerusalem, and he's made sure everything is aligned. They show up with all the articles, everything weighed out exactly. We are here. The first thing they do is they bring the articles in, and then they worship God in the temple. Then they turn around and say, so, it's great to be in Jerusalem. And they realize the priests have all started marrying the foreign women. It's like, this thing's already deteriorating. What a disappointment. I was thinking this was going to be Jerusalem. And I get here, and it's like, looks like it did when we were sent into captivity. So he's upset. He sat there appalled until evening. We have the evening sacrifice. And then at the evening sacrifice, he goes what he figures the best thing to do. He's going to mourn all day, and when he's got a chance, he's going to enter the temple and offer sacrifices. Verse 5, that the evening sacrifice, I rose for myself abasement with my tunic and cloak torn and fell on my knees with my hands spread out to the Lord my God and prayed. And he prays this prayer. First paragraph there, he talks about the past. Then he talks about in verse 8, but now, after the past of judgment, but now, for a brief moment, the Lord our God has been gracious in leaving us a remnant. We've been wiped out. But now, for a brief moment in history, in the year 458, here we are, back in the land, with our temple. We've got provisions and permission from the king, Artaxerxes. A brief moment of blessing, and then they end up in this situation right here. Notice the interesting here in verse 9. Though we are slaves in the Persian Empire, our God has not deserted us in our bondage. He has shown us kindness in the sight of the kings of Persia, from Cyrus all the way down to Artaxerxes. He has granted us, look at this term right here, has granted us new life. You know, I mean, we're not talking about the born-again experience, but for the Jews, it was, as a nation, it was new life. They're back again from captivity. And as we've talked about the five cycles of discipline, cultures do not do this. Cultures don't go through one, two, three, four cycles of discipline, Leviticus chapter 26, and then after they've had complete national overthrow, pull themselves back together and start over. It never has happened in history. The Jews have done it twice. And this right here was the new life that they've been brought into, again, as a nation. We're not talking about salvation there in the sense of the new birth, but an interesting term. Verse 10, but now, O God, we can say after this. What can we say after this? For we have disregarded the commands you gave through your servants the prophets. And then he has a quote right there in verses 11 and 12. And basically what he does, he combines a verse out of Deuteronomy, Isaiah, and Ezekiel about the sin they've just committed. He doesn't just grab a verse out of, you know, Leviticus and bring it over. He takes all the, you know, the prophets and the law of Moses and combines it and says, this is not what we're supposed to be doing. After the graciousness that God has shown us, we come over here and squander it on this. Verse 13, what has happened to us is as a result of our evil. Verse 14, he says, shall we again break your commands and intermarry with the peoples who committed such detestable practices? And of course, it's going to be, no, that's, you know, rhetorical. We should not do this. Chapter 10, while Ezra was praying and confessing, now again, we're going to see this two or three times tonight, that word confessing. It's not a New Testament principle in 1 John 1. Confess your sins, and he's faithful and just to forgive you. You see that in the Psalms. You see David practicing it. You see Ezra. You see Nehemiah confessing the sin. And as confessing it, it's what is to be done, is admitting it that this was wrong and God is right. But just notice that. Praying and confessing, weeping and throwing himself down before the house of God, a large crowd of Israelites, men and women and children, gathered around. They too wept bitterly. They hadn't seen this kind of repentance before. Everybody's kind of grown accustomed. And here comes Ezra from Babylon. You think someone coming from Babylon would be corrupt? But the guy coming from Babylon is he's got his integrity. He's got the word of God. And he's among the Jews in Jerusalem. And he's acting like this, saying, this is terrible. What a disgrace. And people go, wow. Yeah, it is. Thanks for pointing it out. And they begin to join him. Verse 2. Then Shechaniah, son of Jehiel, one of the descendants of Elam, said to Ezra, we have been unfaithful to our God by marrying foreign women from the people around us. Now, again, what caused this is a variety of different answers. One, they may have just been attracted to them. Two, some think that they had married Jewish women, and then when they got over there, they divorced their wives and chose these Canaanite or foreign women. Malachi addresses this. Remember, we're heading towards the book of Malachi, and Malachi, he's going to say, you've abandoned the covenant of your youth with your wife. You've put her away. So, I mean, even in there is an issue. So, possibly that. One of the things that's going to be hard for us, for me, I understand what Ezra's doing here. I understand the concept. Indeed, I understand. Look what happened to Solomon. But they're going to end up sending these wives and their children away. You know what I'm saying? It's kind of like, like Abraham had Hagar and Ishmael. Abraham and Ishmael were father and son. I mean, up until God convinced him that Isaac was the rightful heir, the one that was the chosen one, Abraham was all fine. Ishmael's he's going to be my heir. God says, no, he's not. Yeah, no, I think he's fine. I can use Ishmael. Love Ishmael. Ishmael was Abraham's son until God convinced him that Isaac was one. And there had to come a time where Abraham had to send Ishmael away to keep into God's plan. So it's kind of hard for us to imagine taking our families and sending them away to obey the law of God. It's just hard. I just can't imagine coming into a church and saying, okay, if you married a spouse that is a non-believer, you're going to have them leave now and no more communication, no more contact with them. Your kids, yeah, they go with your wife or your unbelieving husband. I mean, how? How can? I mean, it doesn't even make sense. Yeah, in a sense it does, but I mean, it's too harsh. Nonetheless, verse 5. So Ezra rose up and put the leading priests and Levites and all of Israel under an oath to do what had been suggested. Oh, excuse me, I skipped this. This guy had stood up and he says in verse 3, now let us make a covenant before our God to send away all these women and their children. Now all these women are your wives and these children are your family. But they're going to do it. In accordance with the counsel of my Lord and of those who fear the commands of our God, let it be done according to the law. Rise up, this matter is in your hands. We will support you, so take courage and do it. So Ezra rose up. He takes the position of leadership. And putting the leading priests and Levites and all of Israel under an oath to do what he had been suggested. And he said, we're all under oath. So they all came under oath. They all took the oath or swore to the oath. Then Ezra withdrew from before the house of God and went to the room of Jehonahan, Eliashib. While he was there, he ate no food, no drink. Verse 7, a proclamation was then issued throughout Judah and Jerusalem for all the exiles to assemble in Jerusalem. Everybody's going to come to Jerusalem. We're going to have a big get-together, a big assembly meeting. Anyone who failed to appear within 3 days would forfeit all his property. And this is some harsh stuff right now. Everybody's going to come. Everybody's going to do this thing. And if you don't show up, it's just like losing your genealogy. You've lost your inheritance. You've lost your property. In accordance with, now notice, in accordance with, doesn't say the law of God. It says in accordance with the decision of the officials and elders, and he would also, himself would be expelled from the assembly of the exiles. So he'd be kicked out of the camp. Might as well go live with the Samaritans. Follow your wife up to Samaria because you're not a Jew any longer. And again, notice the difference between the law of God and here a decision of the officials. Again, I don't want to become critical of this by any means. But I do want you to notice when Jesus shows up, can you see where this is heading? We're not even into Nehemiah and the rest of this yet. But this is heading into some very stringent legal codes. And Jesus is going to address this with the Pharisees and the religious people of his day. It says, you've missed the point of the law. You've missed it. Now, are they missing it right here? Or as we go through these chapters? Or are they on track right here, but this is going to become the foundation of where they become too legalistic? Remember why they went to Babylon. They went to Babylon because of idol worship. They went after false gods and foreign ideas. They were judged for that. They've now come back and they are building them. Ezra is going to build them a fence around themselves so they will never. Jesus didn't chew his people out when he came in his generation. He didn't chew the Israelites out for being idol worshippers or having false gods or following after, you know, Baal or Asherah. They wouldn't even do that. They were all about the temple and the law of Moses. What Jesus got upset about was, you've missed the point. And again, you can remember that. Again, I'm not saying that's happening here. I'm just saying you can see the seeds of this becoming very, very legalistic and having to have some correction and going to cause a problem again on the other end. Well, within 3 days, verse 9, within 3 days all the men of Judah and Benjamin had gathered, and on the 20th day of the ninth month all the people were sitting in a square before the house of God, greatly distressed by the occasion and because of the rain. they're getting ready to send their families away, plus it's raining, and they're sitting in the city square. Then Ezra the priest stood up and says, you have been unfaithful. You have married foreign women, adding to Israel's guilt. Now can you just imagine? Remember, Ezra's the new guy in town. You know, he just gets to town and starts making people send their wives home. Now make confession to the Lord, the God of your fathers, to do His will. Separate yourselves from the peoples around you and from your foreign wives. The whole assembly responded with a loud voice, you are right, we must do as you say, but there are many people here, and it is here the rainy season, so we cannot stand outside. Besides, this matter cannot be taken care of in a day or two because we have sinned greatly in this thing. We can't just do this day. One, it's raining. We have all these people here. Two, this is going to take some organization to send all these people away. So they have to get this all organized, and they decide to follow that. And we end this book right here, with verse 18. Among the descendants of the priests, the following had married foreign women. And here's a list. We end the book of Ezra with a blacklist. These are the people who did not do what was right. And it names them for having married these foreign women. Verse 44, the last verse says, all these had married foreign women, and some of them had children by these wives. I understand the concept. We got to keep ourselves pure, but you can just see if this was absolutely the right thing to do, which I'm going to have to say it was the right thing to do, hard to swallow, but must have been the right thing to do, you can see how doing it right this time could have become very corrupt in another 10, 50, 100 years, or by the time Jesus comes around, how having this as your example and the hardness of it, if that is the way you lived your life, how very legalistic it could be. Anyway, well, turn the page. That is around 458 during these some events. Around 446 now, we're back in Babylon. We're back in Susa, actually. And if there's a map there in your books we could go look at. Major cities of Babylon, Persepolis, Ecbatana, Susa, all of their Persian cities. And there is, Artaxerxes is still on the throne. There is now a cupbearer named Nehemiah. He's a Jew. There would be several cupbearers. It'd be like the kitchen staff. They're not just a kitchen staff, but they're people that are around the king taking care of him. There'd be several on staff. It wasn't just be Nehemiah taking care of this king. There'd be several of them in this position. So again, this is Artaxerxes. This is not just your average king. This is the emperor of the Persian Empire. This man's got, he's doing a great job of ruling the empire, but he's very, very powerful. And, you know, his word is law. So here we go. And you guys have heard this taught before, but let's run through this. The words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaiah, or Hakaliah. In the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa. Citadel, that'd be like a fortress, a palace fortress in Susa. The year is 446, November, December. One of a man by the name of Hananiah, now he's going to come up later. This is Nehemiah's brother. Hananiah had been in Jerusalem, and he returns back to Susa. He's going to go back and visit. One of my brothers came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that survived the exile and also about Jerusalem. Those that had made it through the exile and were back in Jerusalem, he says, how is it going? Now, remember, Ezra's there. The walls haven't built up. Ezra's dealing with the foreign women problem. But these walls remain broken down. They've tried to do some building. But remember, the opposition has been there from the day one. They had opposition on the temple. They've had opposition to building the city. They definitely have had opposition against the walls being built. And again, it's going to mention the walls being torn down, the gates being burnt. That could be the remains of Nebuchadnezzar, but it could be the continuous battle these people are under right here. Verse 3, they said to me, those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been burned with fire. Again, I do not think that's Nebuchadnezzar's fire. I will tell you these things if I can read them here in my notes in my Bible. Josephus records about these times right here. See, we just know that he just mentioned the walls and the gates. Josephus says, besides the walls being thrown down, the neighboring nations did a great deal of harm to Jerusalem. They're continually attacking it, plundering it. The daytime was filled with pillage. You go out even in the daytime, you'd go out and travel, you would be pillaged. They would attack you. He says there, Josephus records, there were dead bodies around. And you'd go out in the streets, there'd be dead people laying around in the streets because they'd been attacked on their journeys. Captives, we can see this later on here also, is a reference in Nehemiah here, of people had been taken captive by Samaria or Transjordan Jews, and because they can't protect themselves, they've been taken captive as slaves. So when this person says, Hananiah says to Nehemiah that there's great trouble, disgrace, the walls are broken down and burnt with fire, it is a land in trouble. When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. Now again, remember, he's a Jew anticipating great things in Jerusalem. We've already gone through Zechariah's prophecies, Haggai's prophecy, Zerubbabel and Joshua had come and they've now gone, they've died. And all this great momentum of we're going to build this and we're going to go on to a great age of the Messiah. And now our people are being sold as slaves. You can't go out in the streets. There's dead bodies all over. Our walls are broken down. And if we do build a gate, someone comes and burns down the gate. We continually get plundered. Even during the day, we're getting plundered. And Nehemiah, it's like, it bothers Nehemiah. When I heard these things, I sat down and wept for some days. I mourned and fasted and prayed before for God of heaven. Then I said, now one of the things that is a theme throughout the book of Nehemiah is Nehemiah's on-the-spot prayers. He prays. And here, right here, in this situation, he records the prayer. He confesses the sins. You can see again in verse 6 there, I confess the sins of sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's house, have committed against you. So there he's confessing sins again, saying we were wrong. Remember the instructions you gave your servant Moses, saying you are, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But, verse 9, but if you return to me and obey my commands, then even in your exiled people, even if your exiled people are at the furthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. So in other words, no matter if they get scattered, he said, you even told Moses, you're going to bring us back. And so he says, I'm expecting these things. And then he says right here at the end of that chapter, give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man, talking about the king. And then he says, I was the cupbearer to the king. He realizes, similar to Esther, Esther was, you know, with Xerxes, was for a time, for this season, Esther was there in the palace with the king. Well, Nehemiah, in a sense, finds himself in the same thing. It's a generation later, but now he is in the presence of the king, hearing these things, and it's like, well, it's time. I need to say something. Well, chapter 2. In the month of Nisan, it'd be March or April of 445, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, again, here it's time to serve him his wine, I took the wine and gave it to the king. Either it was his turn or he took the initiative or that was his assignment for the day. He brings it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before. Again, this is a fairly serious thing. I even was looking in some books tonight, and whenever you approach, there's images carved on the wall in stone of the cupbearers coming up to Artaxerxes, and they'd always have to walk with their right hand in front of their mouths so as not to defile it with their breath. You know, you didn't just walk into the king and say, hey, here's your wine, can I get you something else? Or, you know, how's the world going today? How's the economy? You didn't even talk to him. And Nehemiah was coming into him, and notice the king right here had never seen him sad in his presence, which means there's a certain demeanor you had to have when he came to the king. You could come in all bummed out and upset about something. It's like, no, the king didn't care about your feelings, and you didn't need to express them. But here Nehemiah's, the king picks up on it. So the king asked me. Now, I do want you to notice Artaxerxes. He could just slice and dice someone's head off and just go on with another cupbearer. But Artaxerxes, after being on the throne for some 20 years and being very successful, he knows Nehemiah, and he says, why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart. What's bothering you? Can you imagine the emperor asking you, what's bothering you? And you're a cupbearer. I mean, that's a pretty impressive thing. What's going on? And we're going to find out as we read this, the queen is sitting next to Artaxerxes. Well, nonetheless. Nehemiah realizes that this has now turned into a personal conversation with the emperor of the Persian Empire. I was very much afraid, he says. Oh, this could end very bad. But I said to the king, in other words, in a sense, he takes courage, doesn't say this, but I would assume, he says, I was very afraid, just like Esther was very afraid. I don't want to do this. Now here's Nehemiah, he's very afraid, but he realizes he is in a position, it's like Jerusalem is in rubble, people are dying daily in Jerusalem, I might as well join them. I'm going to at least put my petition in. I was very much afraid, but I said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? He says, I'm upset. The king said, what is it you want? What can we do? What do you want? Now, if I ask you, what do you want? It's like, well, I'll pray about that. But when Artaxerxes says, what do you want? It's like, okay, I can do that. So when he says, what do you want? Notice again, Nehemiah. It says, then I prayed to the God of heaven. Now, he didn't drop down on his knees and go off in a 10-minute prayer. It's like he says, give me wisdom. I'm not sure what he says, but he prays to the God of heaven. It's like, this is a moment in time right here. And I answered the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my fathers are buried so that I can rebuild it. Now, that request right there, send me to the Jerusalem so I can rebuild the city. Okay, well, a couple weeks, how long do you want to be gone? I mean, that very request means more than just you have some time off. It means if he's going to rebuild the city, he's going to need some supplies. You know, I'm going to rebuild the city. I'm going to need something. Well, then the king with the queen sitting beside him asked, how long will your journey take, and when will you get back, if it please the king to send me So I set a time. And so in other words, it's almost like the king is, you've got permission, or you've got, what do you need? But I just need to know, when are you going to leave? When are you going to be back? And it's going to be about 20 years. It'll be about 20 years. Okay, well, here's your stuff. I also said to him, if it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates. He also realizes, wait a minute, I'm going into a war zone in a sense. I can't just walk in there and says, Artaxerxes said I could build this. I'm going to need letters. I'm going to need permission so that when I get there, the other governors know I'm here with your permission. Letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates so that they will provide me with safe conduct until I arrive in Judah. He doesn't have the same, faith as Ezra, or the same testimony he's got to stick up for. He says, I want a guard. I want soldiers traveling with me. Notice the difference. Ezra's going to go it alone. Nehemiah says, I want a bodyguard. And may I have the letter to Asaph, keeper of the king's forest. He's in charge of all the lumber. So he will give me the timber to make beams for the gate, to the citadel, and the temple, and for the city wall, and the residence I will occupy. Also, I'll need a house. So I need lumber for that. And because of the gracious hand of my God was upon me, the king granted me my request. He says, God was there. He says, I asked it. And he says, okay, you got a PO I can sign? There you go. So I went to the governors of, and now again, we don't get any details here about his journey per much right here at this point. He says, I went to the governors of Trans-Euphrates and gave them the king's letters. The king had also sent army officers and a cavalry with me. When Sanballat, the Horonite, he's from Samaria. That could be a variety of different places there that he's from, but he's the governor of Samaria. And Tobiah, the Ammonite, he would be the governor on the other side of the Jordan. So those are the two, Sanballat and Tobiah were the two governors that I was talking about earlier. They were very much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. Now, as you look at this right here, this is history, but there's so many different phrases that are in this that pertain, that fit exactly today. They were disturbed, they were distressed that someone was helping the Israelites. We just want to overrun them. We just want to make problems for them. He's like, no, we're going to build the walls. And you just see that almost some of the same attitudes you see today are coming right out of this book. Well, anyway, verse 11. I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there 3 days, you know, he's got to rest for 3 days, I set out during the night with a few men. I had not told anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. Again, notice, he thinks God has put it in his heart. God didn't give him a vision. God didn't speak to him or give him a command. He just knows he's burdened by this. He says, I give God the credit that I am here and I want to build this wall. God had put it in my heart to build this wall. There were no mounts with me except the one I was riding on. In other words, when he got there on his horse, how many horses does Israel have or Jews have? Apparently no horses. So he's out on his horse. And I'm going to read through this just because this is what I do. Because I find this interesting. I could just say that he went around and inspected the wall and we could be off with that and everybody would be happy. But he's going to come out right here. He's going to come out of this valley gate and he's going to go around. And it's amazing when you put this all together that, again, these aren't exactly the exact location. Some of them are, but some of these are kind of, when you read this, he's going to have to hit these in a certain order. And this also pertains to how they rebuilt the wall. So here we go. By night I went out through the valley gate. And again, I could point this out to you, but you can kind of follow this. Went out through the valley gate towards the jackal well and the dung gate. Now the jackal well, that means he's heading south right down here. And the pool of Siloam is right here. Hezekiah's tunnel flows something like this across here. So he's heading down towards the pool of Siloam. Is that another name for the pool of Siloam? Some would say, yeah. After the destruction, the pool of Siloam that Hezekiah built, that was rebuilt by Herod, that we can still see today, that they've excavated it. By this time, it was just a place for jackals to get water, just a watering hole. And so the well of the jackals, maybe it's the same place. And the dung gate, which would be down here, so they take everything out into the Hinnom Valley, which became a dump after the days of Josiah turned after Manasseh was offering all the child sacrifice down here. That became a burning dump, and they would just take the dung out the gates right here. Use the potter. In Jeremiah's day, this was the potter's part of the city. But examining the walls of Jerusalem, which had been broken down, and its gates, which had been destroyed by fire. Then I moved on towards the fountain gate and the king's pool, which apparently are on this side. This is going to be where the palace is located. The Gihon Springs are right here, and there's a tower guarding the Gihon Springs. So this fountain gate right here and the king's pool appears to be right in this area. So he's heading up the Kidron Valley. Now this valley right here is very, very steep. It's a drop-off, right? That's why Jerusalem was such a great fortification. This was a steep drop-off down here in the Kidron Valley. There's another valley running right through here called the Central Valley. That's why this is called the Valley Gate. And then there's another Hinnom Valley coming across over here. And this is actually what is known as Gehenna down into here. But nonetheless, this is a great fortificated place right here. This is very steep. And we're going to have trouble with it right here. So I went up the Fountain Gate and the King's Pool. But there was not enough room for my mount to get through. He came across here, and he can't get through because there's such a steep drop-off and the rubble's covering up any kind of a flat spot. He can't get through. So what he's going to do, he's going to move down into the Kidron Valley, and he's going to move up this way, just going up the Kidron Valley, looking up at the wall. And he is looking up this steep embankment because he's got to look up this wall, or up the valley, and then on top of it would be the city walls. So examining the wall. Finally, I turned back and re-entered through the valley gate. So he goes up through this way, gets up in here somewhere, turns back, and comes back down and enters back to the valley gate this way. And that's all that he saw of the city. Hey, I do want to show you this. Go to page 108 in your books, 108 in your framework books. And while I was there, I did get a picture of this, which includes several things. And this picture on page 108 is taken right here. It's a picture right about here. Well, actually, it's up here. It's up here. And it's the wall that is right underneath the palace of David, where David is being excavated. And you see those stepped rocks right there? That goes way back to the days of the Jebusites. That's the Jebusite wall going back to when David would have taken the city, or even possibly going back to Melchizedek, when Melchizedek was king of Salem. That would be and priest of God Most High. That would have been probably part of the city there, or at least right there. And again, understand this. That would be a very high wall, but that is on top of the Kidron Valley. So I'm looking down. I'm standing up here. I'm standing right about up in here, right on the border between the Temple Mount and the top of David. And I'm taking a picture down this way towards that. But when you stand down in the Kidron Valley and look at that, you're looking up this valley, and then on top of that would be this huge wall. And that's why the Jebusites, when they looked over the wall at David and his men, says, look, we can defend, the blind and the lame can defend the city. You can't get in here. And David and Joab looking up is like, probably not. You know, I mean, there's no way, except they came in through the water shaft that we know. But the point, if you look right behind there, you can see that fairly square corner right there. That dates the days of Nehemiah. That would be part of Nehemiah's wall that they've excavated out, that they found. So again, it's just kind of exciting. You're looking at part of the wall that when Nehemiah went by, that step structure there would have been there, and he wouldn't have been able to get by because it was too much rubble there. But when he gets done building, that corner part right there is going to have been built. So that wasn't there this night, but by the time he gets done, that part's going to be there. Just an interesting fact right there on Nehemiah and the wall. So anyway, let's go back to the Bible, chapter 2, verse 11. He just finished his night inspection of the city. He says, then I said to them, the men that were with him, you see the trouble we are in? He says, you see what's wrong with our country? Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates have been burnt with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem and we will no longer be in disgrace. I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said. Now he says, now let me tell you. The king has already given us permission. Because they're going, we can't do this. How are we going to get this done? I know Artaxerxes. Artaxerxes has signed these papers. And they're going, he says, the gracious hand of God is with us. Look what we can do. They replied, let us start rebuilding. So they began to do this good work. You can kind of hear the same thing that Zechariah provided for the people, that Haggai provided for the people. Let's get this done. Now we're into another generation. They haven't got the walls built. And they say, we just get overrun. We got people dying in the streets. We're being attacked every day. And then Nehemiah shows up and says, guess what? I've got letters from the king. And their first reaction is, let's get it done. Let's do this thing. They reply, let's do it. Well, guess what? Verse 19, but when Sanballat from Samaria and Tobiah from across the Jordan and someone else, the Arab, heard about it, they mocked and ridiculed us. At first, they just mocked and ridiculed. They said, what is this you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king? Well, you can't do this. You're trying. And again, why would anyone, I guess they did against the Romans, But why would they rebel against Artaxerxes? There's not a chance in the world. These guys can't even build a wall, let alone lead a rebellion. But nonetheless, they mocked him. I answered them by saying, this is Nehemiah's response, the God of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding, but as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it. Does that sound familiar? Right. He says, but as for you, you have no share in what we're doing in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right. You can go back and read history all you want to, and you'll never find that you have any presence here in this city. He's telling, well, the last guy I mentioned right there was a Gershom, the Arab. And nonetheless, chapter 3, verse 1. Then it says, now, I don't want to bore you with this. I just really get a kick out of this right here. But if you read, I can't do it. I can't do it to you. But I was planning on, that's why I drew this whole map up. But it'd just be torture, I'm sure. But I want to read chapter 3 to you. But you can take your maps at home and read it. But basically what he's going to do, he starts breaking it down. And he gives names of people and families. And they're going to start right here. From the sheep gate, right here. Let me read the first one at least. That's dangerous. Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. Now, you're going to notice we're going to start with priests building, and then we're going to move this way around, giving names of people and families, including some guys building with his daughters, building their section of the wall from this gate to this gate, or behind their house. They're building all the way up, and then they get right about here. Guess what? They start naming priests again, because there's the temple, and the priests are going to build this section right through here, going from the sheep gate, the fish gate, all the way around. There's the broad wall. Now, it's going to mention the broad wall. And this broad wall was something built by Hezekiah to expand the city. We've talked about that before. They filled in the central valley, built the city over. But the thing is, that had been broken down. There's the remains of it. In fact, today, that has been excavated. There's a huge base of a wall coming right at this part of the city. And you can still see the broad wall, or part of the broad wall that Hezekiah built. Going all the way around, talking about who's building it. And that's chapter 3. Again, I spent a lot of time getting ready to show you that and teach you that, but I just can't. I look at you and I just say, I can't do that to you. Well, I'm just going to read. He's going to walk around and talk about who's all building the city. And I'd just be stumbling through names and stuff, but you can read that. It's kind of neat. But again, there you go. That's all those things are detailed there in that chapter. Well, now we get over to chapter 4. Guess what? Opposition. When Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became angry. Now, again, this is going to get done in a matter of like 52 days. They're going to get this whole thing built. They're going to just fly through this once they get started. But that chapter 3 kind of tells you where everybody's working, and but they've got to build it up. It's not just a few blocks. It's not like a snow fort. This thing's got to be fortified to hold back an army, to be impressive enough that we're not going to get attacked. And the gates have to work. I mean, don't just put a gate up. We're talking a gate is going to be a rock formation with some kind of hinges that are going to swing with some doors that they can shut at night, that they could still be attacked and still hold off, from someone knocking them down. So anyway, it's going to take some while, but nonetheless, 52 days. When Sanballat heard that what we were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and was greatly incensed. Now, at first, he just mocks them. Now they're going through with it. He ridiculed the Jews, and in the presence of his associates and the army of Samaria, he says, "What are those feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they finish in a day? Can they bring the stones back to life from those heaps of rubble burned as they are?" Now Tobiah, across the Jordan, says, "What they are building, if even a fox climbed up on it, he would break it down and knock the wall over." He says, what good is that? He says, if a fox comes up at night and runs down their wall, it's going to knock their wall over. Now Nehemiah right here prays, "Hear us, O God, for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their own heads. Give them over as plunder in the land of captivity. Do not cover up their guilt or blot out their sins from your sight, for they have thrown insult in the face of the builders." So he kind of, he's not really praying for his enemies, really, like what Jesus had said there. But he's praying for curses on them. But nonetheless, so we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height. So they're working for several weeks, apparently, and they're got about half its height done. "For the people worked with all their heart." Now Sanballat realizes that's looking pretty good. They've got a lot of people working. Again, you can read chapter 3. Gives you all the details, who's all working. And they're working feverishly. I'm not sure if I've skipped the verse or not, but it says in some place, or maybe coming up, or I might have skipped it. "But they worked from the time the sun started to rise, they started working until the stars came out." Every day, they're just plowing through this thing. Because it's their chance to become somebody. They have some kind of defense. Notice, no defense, you're not a people. You must have defense. So he rebuilt the wall until it was halfway built. But verse 7, when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arab and the Ammonites and all the men of Ashdod heard that the repairs of Jerusalem's wall had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, the gaps in the wall, they were very angry. They all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble against it. It's like, okay, we need to attack. They're trying to build the defense system. We need to attack that defense system. But we prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. See, we heard about it, so we're getting ready. Meanwhile, the people of Judah, the people that are in the city, says, the strength of the laborers is giving out, and there is so much rubble that we cannot rebuild the wall. Now, discouragement is setting in. The people of Jerusalem are saying, man, we're tired. We've been working from sunrise until the stars come out day after day. We're tired. We can't keep going. So now the murmuring is starting on the inside. Also, our enemy said, before they know it or see us, we'll be right there among them and we'll kill them and put an end to the work. He says they can't guard the city and build. All of a sudden, one day, we're just going to sweep in and take them out. Then the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, whatever you turn, they will attack us. You can't get away from them. Therefore, Nehemiah says, I'm going to have to do something about it. So now he's going to begin to stage. He's going to become part builder, part military. Therefore, I stationed some of the people behind the lowest points of the wall at the exposed place, so the place that were the lowest, where they could get through the easiest. He stations his guards right there to protect that weakness in the wall until they get done. After I looked things over, I stood up and said to the nobles and officials and all the rest of the people, don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, and your daughters, your wives, and your homes. When our enemies heard that we were aware of their plot and that God had frustrated it, we all returned to the wall and each of us to his work. From that day on, half of my men did work and the other half stayed equipped for battle. He carried a trumpet with him. It says in verse 18, he carried a trumpet with him. So there was a plan that if there was an attack, he'd blow the trumpet, or his trumpeter would blow the trumpet, and everyone would assemble. And what would happen most likely is right here, because this is a valley coming through. It's a steep drop off here and a very steep drop off here. And these valleys meet down here and there's a steep drop off here. This historically is where the fortress of Jerusalem in the Jebusites in David's day, this was always where the fortress was at, because you could only attack from the north. Otherwise, you got to climb up these walls. So I'd assume that when he blew the trumpet, they'd all assemble up here to defend the city for an attack. And that's talks about that there. Oh, verse 21, that's the verse I was talking about. So we continued the work with half the men holding spears from the first light of dawn till the stars came out. At that time, I was also told the people, have every man, and tells them how to work. Notice this. I'm going to quit, I think, because I'm kind of getting distracted here, and it's time to wrap this up. But Nehemiah is going to begin to help the poor here. You're going to find out there's a people are enslaved. There's very high usuries taking place, very high interest rates, and people are being oppressed by the Jews themselves. The Jews, the wealthy Jews, are oppressing the poor Jews to the place that it's criminal. They're losing their property, losing their possessions. And Nehemiah makes the point here. He says, we went out of our way to buy back the Jews from captivity from these other nations, just to be brought here to be oppressed by their own people. He says, this isn't right. So he's going to start fixing that as they continue building the walls. The walls are not going to get done it's going to take 52 days, but that's chapter 6, verse 15. And I think we'll pick that up next week and make a run for the rest of the book of Nehemiah and Malachi next week. So anyway, these are some interesting times. Next week, I think we'll see some more details of Nehemiah and how he tries to bring about a restoration in the legal sense or in the religious sense. And some of the things that he does, it's very concerning to me as far as kind of crossing some lines as far as even oppressing people who weren't following the law of Moses the way that he thought it should be followed. Just some things to think about. Again, we're ready. We're entering now. We're getting ready to enter that 400 silent years. And when we come out of that 400 silent years, we're into Jesus' ministry. And what Jesus has to face as far as the religious opposition, I don't know, I can see what Ezra does. Ezra and Nehemiah really laid a foundation for that opposition. Ezra was the one who established the synagogue system. Up until this time, they'd have the temple and they'd have the Levites preaching or teaching. But Ezra's going to set up a synagogue system. He's going to do some great things for Israel. But he kind of wondered about how that was all interpreted and how they applied all of it, because Jesus ran into some issues when he came in his ministry. We'll pray, and then we'll be dismissed. Grab some Christmas CDs if you'd like to. Grab an extra book or something. Put someone's stocking or something for Christmas. Father, we thank you so much for your truth. We thank you for the chance to look into it. We ask that we may find guidance and direction from it. We do thank you for your spirit that lives within us. We thank you for the fellowship we have with other believers. Again, we pray for our nation in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you very much for being here. I appreciate your time.